This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
And our next presenter is Emeritus Professor Rod Holm from the University of Melbourne, who will be talking about Leichhardt and his motivations. And I'm very much looking forward to Rod and his fellow speakers in this session, Tom and Henry, because this is where we come to terms with Leichhardt, the man, and Leichhardt as scientist.
May I begin by saying how pleased I am to be here and congratulate the National Museum on putting on such an interesting symposium today. I'm going to talk in rather general terms about Leichhardt and his background, and because I've seen this as a sort of introduction to the other two papers, really. In the last 20 years or so, there's been a tremendous upsurge of interest in Ludwig Leichhardt, with a considerable number of important new publications that have drawn extensively on both the splendid edition of Leichhardt's correspondence by Arusso, published some years ago, 1968, and on Leichhardt's unpublished diaries in the Mitchell Library, as well, of course, as on the published accounts of his great expedition from Moreton Bay to Port Essington and the aborted expedition of 1847. As a result of all this new work, we can surely at last put behind us the image of Leichhardt that prevailed for many years, of an incompetent dreamer who didn't know what he was doing, who recklessly endangered the lives of his men. This image was presented in particular in Alec Chisholm's scurrilous anti-German diatribe, Strange New World, published in 1941 at the height of the Second World War, and at the height of the wave of anti-German hysteria that swept Australia at that time. In fact, during the two world wars of the 20th century, Australians did their best to erase from their collective memory the many positive contributions the Germans had made to the country since its settlement by Europeans, and Leichhardt's reputation suffered more than most in that process. Now, though, as I say, we can surely put this behind us, because the Leichhardt who emerges from the documents was no incompetent dreamer, but a well-trained scientist and an accomplished field worker who, before he hit it off on his first major journey of exploration, had also spent 2 years learning the bushcraft necessary to survive in unexplored territory. The misassessment of him was only made possible by applying 20th century criteria of behaviour to a 19th century situation when expectations were entirely different. In other words, by being completely unhistorical in making one's judgments. A little pressed for space here. To expand on this a little, let me begin by saying something about Leichhardt's family and financial background. Leichhardt's parents weren't Prussian. They lived in a part of Germany that had become Prussian as part of the post-Napoleonic settlement of the European boundaries. From Leichhardt's point of view, this had the advantage that he was able to profit from the excellent education system set up by the Prussian minister Wilhelm von Humboldt. But it had the disadvantage that he was subject to doing compulsory military service, as well as to oversight by the state authorities in his choice of career. And these constraints he eventually came to reject. Leichhardt's father was a peasant, and a petty government official, a peat inspector. Not sure quite what a peat inspector does, apart from inspecting peat. Anyway, he was not only a petty government official and a peasant, but had a very large family to support, including young Ludwig, whose talents were obviously evident early on because he was sent off to boarding school when he was still quite young, which would have cost the family quite a lot of money, obviously. Ludwig Leichhardt, in fact, attended the classical grammar school, the Gymnasium, at Cottbus, and did well enough there to proceed to the university that Wilhelm von Humboldt had founded in Berlin. Initially, he studied philology, because he'd shown himself particularly good at languages at grammar school. And the intention, presumably, if you were studying something like that, would be that you would become a teacher, either in a university or in a gymnasium when you'd finished. But the expense of attending university, especially if Leichhardt was to gain maximum benefit from his university years by spending part of his time, as was customary, at other universities, a so-called Wanderjahr, the expense was really beyond his father's budget. And so he, like many other young students from poor backgrounds, in that age of enormous differences of wealth and privilege, he relied on wealthy patrons to help cover his costs. As I say, this was a common thing at the time. Had he come from the Catholic part of Germany, of course, another alternative would have been for him to join the church. But the system operated differently in the Prussian lands, in the Protestant part of the country. Most often, poor but intelligent lads looked to wealthy local landowners or perhaps businessmen in the local town for patronage. And Leichhardt certainly tried that. He wrote letters to various people without success. Later on, he was fortunate to make friends with a fellow student, a young Englishman named William Nicholson, who had the resources enough to cover his expenses, as well Leichhardt's expenses, that is, as well as his own, and who eventually gave Leichhardt £200 to cover his initial expenses in going to Australia, which is a very large sum of money in those days. But this sort of situation doesn't make Leichhardt a sponger in the derogatory 20th century sense that has sometimes been applied to him. The arrangement wasn't at all unusual, as I've said already. For the most obvious example, perhaps, think of the countless ladies' companions that one meets in Victorian novels and so forth. Genteel but impoverished women given a home by a wealthier patron. Poorer genteel parts of the community automatically looked for support to the wealthier around them with expectations of getting it. What was perhaps unusual in Leichhardt's situation was that his patronage that he eventually did succeed in attracting came from an English family rather than one based closer to his home. There were many English students at German universities at this time, since they were generally acknowledged to be the best around. But still, Leichhardt's teaming up with one of them undoubtedly opened up wider horizons for him and wider opportunities that he might have found had he had a German patron. I described him earlier as a well-trained scientist. In fact, he was probably the best-trained scientist to practice his craft in Australia to that time. In fact, I'm not sure why I said probably. Let me be more positive. He was the best-trained scientist to practice his craft in Australia to that time. He wouldn't have used the term scientist himself. That was a neologism invented around about 1840. He might probably never even heard the word. He would have called himself a naturalist, but that's beside the point. He was very well trained. To be sure, he never completed any formal qualifications, and that's sometimes been held against him as a criticism in the 20th century. But that's beside the point too. The only people who'd completed qualifications in those days were those aiming for careers as teachers or government officials. If you just went to university to get an education, it didn't matter whether you actually did a formal exam at the end or not, and many people didn't. What counted was what you studied. And thanks to Edith Webster and particularly Colin Roderick, today we have a very good idea of what Leichhardt studied, what his training consisted of. We know that he studied for several years under some of the leading scientists of the age, in some of the world's leading centres of scientific activity, in Göttingen, in Berlin, and in Paris. We know that he worked systematically through the natural history collections of the world's greatest natural history museums, in London and in Paris in particular. We know that he then consolidated his studies with extensive field work in several European countries, before ever he set out for Australia. He'd also done a fair amount of medical study and had followed hospital rounds under some of the leading doctors in both London and Paris. In Germany, if he'd stayed there, that wouldn't have been enough for him to be regarded as a fully qualified medico because he hadn't done enough formal coursework. But he was probably at least as well trained in medicine as most of those who practiced medicine in England or in Australia at the time. And I take it that that was the basis of his being given this sort of honorary label as Dr. Leichhardt in Australia, which was not a label he ever claimed. In fact, he disavowed it several times, but people kept calling him doctor anyway. He never claimed to be a qualified doctor. He saw himself, as I say, as a naturalist. That's what he was. Let me say a bit more about his training. When he went to university, Berlin initially, it took him a while, as it does many young students, to settle on his course of study. As I said, he started off in philology. Later, he tried his hand at public administration for a term or so, before settling definitively into science. I've extracted a list of some of the more prominent of his scientific lecturers, and it really is impressive. Let me show it to you. So he started in Berlin studying philology. Then he went to Göttingen in his Wanderjahr. And you see the three professors that he had that I've listed there. And Bartling was not the greatest botanist of all time. But he was a very competent botanist and he used to take Leichhardt and other students on field excursions on the weekends and things. But Blumenbach and Weber are two of the greatest scientists of the 19th century. Blumenbach was an old man at the time, but he'd more or less invented the field of comparative anatomy and had made extraordinarily large contributions to it. Weber was a young man at this time, but was one of the principal figures in the history of electrodynamics in particular of the 19th century. I suppose one should regard the period in Göttingen and in Berlin in effect as Leichhardt's undergraduate training and his period in Paris, which I'll push the thing up in a moment, as his postgraduate training. Those people that I've listed in Berlin are also extremely well known in the history of science. Mitscherlich was a major figure in the history of chemistry. Ehrenberg invented the study of microscopic organisms, infusoria and that sort of stuff. Magnus was probably the leading figure in applied physics in 19th century Germany. So these are important people. And then we go to Paris, and there's a whole lot more of them. And some of these names are well known today still, others perhaps not so well known, but they were very well known in their day and are all leading figures in their respective fields. Paris is important because Paris was the world centre of science at the time. The Muséum d'Histoire Naturelle had probably the world's greatest natural history collection at the time, including rich Australian collections from those great French exploring expeditions of the late 18th and early 19th centuries that Leichhardt was able to study. A lot of the people that are listed there were actually professors at the museum. They gave courses of lectures. You'll notice an increasing level of specialisation amongst them as well. This is characteristic of a general development in science at the time, but especially in Paris, and that's partly why Paris was the leading centre that had a lot of specialists. The geological professor, Prévost, took Leichhardt on expeditions around the Paris Basin, which is a rich geological site. In London, I think that'll do for that list. In London, Leichhardt didn't attend lectures. He did the hospital rounds, as I mentioned, but he also attended various museums, the Hunterian Museum and the British Museum in particular. And at the British Museum, he met Richard Owen, the famous paleontologist. Under the guidance of these people, his mind quickly opened and his ambitions developed. Already in Göttingen during his Wanderjahr, he wrote to his brother-in-law that, I've got a few nice little quotes here. If I do study further, it won't be because I want to graduate and become a professor. I want to strike a vein of interest which, with God's help, will lead me further than that would. And his father, talking about his younger brother's upbringing, but in words that equally could apply to himself, the work a man likes, then let him do. His fertile mind, ever taut and alert, will then strive onward. Everything new affords him a new interest. 1,000 new pages ask for his attentive reading. Or again to his father, the more mental sustenance we can accumulate, the more calmly we can await the future. Leichhardt was actually an extremely hard worker. He worked very hard to accumulate more and more mental sustenance in this way throughout his period as a student and subsequently in Australia. Auro so described this in his introduction to the correspondence in regard to the Australian period in the following terms. He says, Leichhardt was obsessive and energetic, and his prodigious output of physical collections and his written observations was only sustained by working, and then he quotes Leichhardt himself, from 7 in the morning until midnight. Leichhardt also thrived on the outdoors, on field studies, as he wrote during his first field expedition in the Harz Mountains in Germany. This vigorous travelling on foot, this contemplative moving about amongst the wonders of nature, this delightful alternation of fatigue and repose have a strong and enduring fascination. I would wander around like this all my life if I could. My mind is insatiable, he wrote in another letter. Gradually during this period, he and Nicholson formed the idea of becoming scientific travellers. Excuse me. And by around the end of 1839, they'd settled on Australia as their destination, inspired partly by the fact that Nicholson's younger brother, Mark, had just moved to Australia. But first, Leichhardt insisted, he needed more field experience. Nicholson wasn't nearly so keen on this, and in fact Nicholson, fairly soon after this, dropped out of the grand plan of visiting Australia. But Leichhardt, as I say, wanted some field experience, so he spent several months tramping around some of the most geologically interesting parts of Europe. The Massif Central in France, that's Auvergne, around Naples and Mount Vesuvius, the Apennines, the Alps. Eventually he came to Australia. He was 28 at the time. He had no money, apart from what he'd been given by Nicholson, but he was obviously fired with ambition to study the Australian natural history. He'd studied Australian materials in Paris and probably in London, but he was certainly no expert on Australian forms. But then he spent the next couple of years familiarising himself with these, as we'll hear from Tom Darrow in a moment, as well as learning the bushcraft skills that he needed. This kind of background made Leichhardt very different from the general run of Australian explorers. Most of these, if they had any technical training in their background, had been trained as surveyors. Speaking here about the land explorers, of course, not the shipborne ones, especially the French shipborne ones carried ones, especially the The French shipborne ones carried ones, especially 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 the French shipborne ones carried ones.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it... The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it... The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it... The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it... The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it...